Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew, and tonight I'd like to welcome retired airline captain, former CIA pilot, and son of the inventor of the Lear jet, John Lear. How are you tonight, Mr. Lear?
Oh, pretty good, Chris. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm very good. Excellent. And I want to thank you again for joining us. And tonight, I thought we'd start with your fascinating background. Give us a little bit about that and what brought you to your fascinating research that you've been doing about this information you've uncovered.
Well, you know, I grew up mostly in Santa Monica, where my dad had his company, Lear Incorporated, and he made all kinds of equipment and hydraulic actuators and stuff for the military. And there was always airplanes around to fly, and so I got started at an early age, and I always just wanted to be an airline pilot, and he just couldn't see that. He said, "Well, why don't you be a doctor or a lawyer, then you can have your own airplane." I said, "Well, no, I want to fly it for somebody else," and he couldn't get that, so we parted company, and I just went on my own way, and I started off flight instructing, and then I went to the Flying Tiger line in the executive division, and I ran their charter service, which had a couple of Learjets, and from there, I tried to start an airline in Las Vegas, and that wasn't successful, and I did some charter work for Clay Lacy Aviation in Van Nuys, and ended up ferrying airplanes for the military to Vietnam between 1967 and 1970. And I ferried the forward air control O2A, which was the military version of the Cessna 337. And in 1970, came back, worked for Clay a little bit, and then I got with an airline that that had 707s. And Marilyn, can you stop it? They were up in Seattle and had an air club up there, a club, and got checked out in the 707. And from there went over to Lebanon to fly for TMA, and they had 707s. We flew worldwide, and let's see, from there went did some flying in the Middle East, actually from Budapest down to Somalia, and came back to the U.S., flew for a couple airlines, ended up with American Transair, and flew for them until 1989, and then started flying with a couple of air cargo airlines, Coletta and Rosenbaum and Kittyhawk International. And retired at, I think I was 58 when Kittyhawk went bankrupt, and nobody's going to hire a pilot for the last 2 years of their career, because mandatory retirement was 60. Now it's 65, and it's going to 67, and it'll probably go to on condition, which means if you can pass the physical, you can fly. And the reason is, Boeing just put out an announcement here about 2 or 3 months ago, that they figured that within 20 years, that's within by 2038, that the requirement for pilots would be 970,000 pilots required then. So they're not sure where the amount of pilots is going to come from, but yeah. What they're going to have to do is raise the age from 67 to on condition, to even get near that amount. So,
wow.
An airline pilot, now's the time.
Yeah, very interesting. Good information. Now, I understand that, you know, bringing you to the research you've done, you've actually seen some crafts, some UFOs. Is that correct?
Yeah, I actually, I saw some. I didn't know what they were. I wasn't interested in UFOs that time. At that time, I remember descending into Los Angeles. Oh, let's see, would have been, I was with the time, I think I was with doing charter. That would have been in the middle 60s. And this object passed me on descent going from the rear to in front, from left to right. And I thought it was the M2F2, if you remember, the airplane that the $6 million man crashed in. They call it the flying bathtub. That's what I thought it was. And I even called the chief pilot of Learjet at that time and told him what I'd seen. Only years later did I realize how ridiculous that was, that they wouldn't be flying an M2F2 through the approach corridor of Los Angeles. And so I figured out that's what I saw, but I didn't realize it for many years after. And then I saw a couple others. Of course, Bob Lazar took me out in March 22nd of 1989 to see the one fly that he worked on up at S4 near Groom Lake. And he knew the time and the day they were going to test fly it. And we drove out there, and sure enough, it came up, and it was flitting around the sky, and it was hard to track. I had a Celestron 8 telescope, but then it stopped and started descending straight down behind the mountains, and I got it focused in and had a good view for about 15 or 20 seconds as it descended behind the mountains. So, you know, what I saw was your classic flying saucer, and it was gold, yellowish gold in color, and it was radiating something, a substance, off the surface as it descended. And I don't know what it was radiating, but something was kind of spilling off the surface. And it was oriented to the horizontal about 30 degrees as it came down. And just like I say, it was just for about 15, 20 seconds.
Now, is this the event that really brought you, to your current research that you've been doing, or was there more instances?
Well, the beginning was really in 1985. I used to run the reunions for the pilots that flew in Southeast Asia for the different companies. We used to meet here every 2 years in Las Vegas. And in 1985, I ran into a friend, Greg Wilson, who was a Raven. They were the Sheep Dip Air Force pilots that flew in Laos. And I hadn't seen him for a while. And I said, "Where all you been?" He said, "Well, you know, he's still flying the A-10. And he was had been based at Bentwaters." And I said, "Oh, Bentwaters, that's where that flying saucer supposedly landed in during Christmas of 1980. He said, "No, not supposedly, it did." He said, "I didn't get to see it because I was confined to quarters, but I know the guys who did." And I said, "You mean this stuff is real? There really are saucers?" He said, "Oh yeah, there are." That's what really got me going. And then I started researching. Of course, those days we didn't have the internet, so everything was by phone, and all the people that were involved in actual, you know, recoveries wouldn't talk anything on the phone. And so I had to drive around quite a bit. One trip I went throughout Colorado, Arizona, talking to different people. and getting information. And it seemed like every time that I would get as far as I thought I was ever going to get, I would learn something else that was even more fantastic. And I kept doing that until, you know, I ended up meeting Bob Lazar. And at that time, that was in the summer of 1988, and he came over with Gene Huth, and Gene was a appraiser, and he was going to appraise my house, and Bob came over. He was going to hold. He was a friend of Gene's, and he was going to hold the measuring tape. But Gene was interested in saucers and wanted to trade all of the information I had and videotapes for an appraisal, which I agreed to. So when he got over here, we started talking and trading stories. And Bob couldn't have been less interested. He kept rolling his eyes. And you know, we said, "What's the matter, Bob?" He said, "You guys are nuts." He said, "I worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories." He said, "I had the highest clearance you could get there as a scientist." And he said, "If there was anything about that that was true, I would have known that." And so over the next like 4 or 5 months, we tried to get Bob interested, showing the information we had. For instance, there was a place, a secret place in Los Alamos where they kept the live alien, and the address was YY-2. And he found out there might not be an alien there, but that was a very classified address. And then we told him there was this secret bomb being made called Excalibur, which could penetrate the ground to about 1,000 feet. And he found out that was true. And then there was one other thing. But anyway, the culmination was that he thought maybe there was something to this. And if there was, then it was probably going on at Groom Lake. So he knew about Groom Lake. He'd never been there, but he did know Dr. Teller, Edwin Teller, the father of the H-bomb. And he called him and told him that he wanted to reenter the scientific community, which he'd been out for a couple of years. And Dr. Teller said, "Do you want to work for me here at Lawrence Livermore here in California, or do you want to work in Nevada?" And Bob said, "I want to work at Groom Lake." I was there when he made the call. So Teller said, "Let me see what I can do." So about 3 weeks later, Bob gets a call to go down to EG&G for an interview. Now, EG&G stands for Edgerton, Germishausen, and Greer, and they were three of the primary scientists on the atomic bomb project in Los Alamos. And after the war, they came out to Nevada and started a company that ran, more or less, took care of and ran the test site. And so anyway, in would have been October of 89, or 88, Bob came over to my house and said that he had just been in an interview with EG&G for a job up at Groom Lake. And I said, "How'd you do?" He said, "I aced it." He said, "I knew everything, all the questions they asked. I had done experiments on several things they asked." And he said, "I was going to get another interview in a couple of weeks," which they told him they would call him back. So they called him back again for a second interview, and that interview was where they said, "Do you know John Lear, and what's your opinion of John Lear?" And Bob, I said, "What'd you tell him?" And Bob says, "I told him that I knew you, but I thought you stuck your nose into places where it didn't belong." He said, "What I didn't tell them is I also like to stick my nose into places it doesn't belong." On December 6th, the reason I remember this, it was such an important date in my friendship with Bob. December 6th, he came over, and as he usually did in the evening, and we started chatting, and he said, "I saw a disc today." I said, "What?" He said, "I saw a disc today." I said, "Theirs or ours?" He said, "Theirs." I said, "You went to Groom Lake?" He said, "Yeah, yeah, I went to Groom Lake." And he said, "I got to see it, got to go inside it, had to sign a lot of papers, security briefing." I said, "Bob, what are you doing here? Why don't you go, you know, work for them for a while, find out what's going on, and then tell me? You got to know that they followed you, right? And you probably won't get to go back." And he said, "No, the reason I'm doing this is because over the years, or over the last 4 or 5 months, I've seen you take so much crap over this UFO thing. I wanted to say, it's true. You're right. They are extraterrestrial. I've seen them. I've been in them. And they're hundreds of thousands of years ahead of us in technology." And so, as it turns out, the people that hired Bob knew that he was going to come to me, and that's the reason they hired him, because they wanted somebody who was knowledgeable enough to understand what was going on, but that also had some things in their background that would make them instantly discreditable. In other words, they'd be able to discredit him instantly if things started going south. In other words, if the public reacted wrong, or it got to be a problem, they could just say, "Oh, it's not true. We never had this guy. And look at his background. He used to live in Reno, and he ran a cat house, and da 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 da." Right. But anyway, that's why they hired him, and so they discredited him, and they knew that he would tell me what was going on, and that I would tell everybody else. And all they wanted to know was, how would the public react if they knew what they were doing? And it's my understanding that the guy that was in charge of that, MJ-1, Majestic 1, was a guy named McConnell. I'm trying to think of his first name. Admiral McConnell, and it was his idea to hire Bob and to hire somebody that they could instantly discredit. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but they did definitely hire him, and he worked up there until April 6th of 89, which is the third night we went out to see the UFOs fly, the third Wednesday night. And we got caught by security, and the next morning, Bob's boss, a guy named Dennis Mariana, called Bob and said, "Bob, don't go to work today. I'm going to come pick you up, and we're going to drive up the road a little bit." So came pick up Bob, and they drove up to what was then called Indian Springs Air Force Auxiliary. Now it's called Creech Air Force Base, but it's always been the base where the all the center of security is for the Nevada test site. And there's, you know, several people that use it in a Nevada test site. You know, they use it to test atomic weapons. They use it for Groom Lake. They use the Tonopah test range for other things. And the one security outfit runs security for the whole test site. So Dennis Mariana picked up Bob and drove him up to Indian Springs. And when they got up there in front of the security place, they took him out of the car with a gun in his ear and took him into this office and said, "Now, Bob, when we gave you this clearance, it didn't mean you were supposed to take all of your friends up to this site and show them the flying saucers. It's a secret." And he was noncommittal about the thing, but, you know, he never did go back. And one of the reasons, there were several reasons why he didn't go back, but one of the reasons was the last two trips that he made up to Groom Lake, he would, the way that he would get up there was he'd go to the southern part of McCarran Airport, where EG&G had a facility that was right next to the runway. And the Boeing 737 would pull in there, the red and white one, the white with a red stripe, and he'd get on that with a couple other people and fly up to Groom Lake, and then they'd bus him from Groom Lake down to Papoose Lake, which was about a 30-minute dirt road bus ride. And so he said that when I asked him, you know, if he was going to go back, he said, I don't think I will, because the last two times I went up there, I could remember going up the boarding steps to the 737, and I, at the beginning of the day, and I could remember coming down those steps at the end of the day, but I couldn't remember anything in between. As much as I tried, I could not remember what I did. So he said, I don't want to work at a place under those conditions. I want to know what I'm doing and be able to remember it. And what that tells us, of course, is the secret government, whoever runs this, their ability to control your mind control, is so highly advanced now that they can make you believe anything you want, and not remember anything that they don't want you to remember.
Yeah.
Which is why they've been able to keep, such high level secrets. You know, the other day, a couple months ago, President Trump announced that he was going to start a new space command, which would be in addition to the Air Force, Navy, Marines. But what he was, the president doesn't know, at least he didn't tell the public he knew, was there has already been a space command for 40 years in operation. The U.S. Navy runs it. It's called the U.S. Navy Space Command. It's run out of Kwajalein Island in the South Pacific, and they have between 1,000 and 1,500 astronauts, current and qualified, that most of them are in orbit all the time on all their different projects they got going. Excuse me. And, you know, some of the projects they've got is they have 13 orbiting direct energy weapons, one of which they used during 9/11 to destroy buildings 1, 2, and 7. And they also have some steel factories up there orbiting.
Now, that is fascinating. That's one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, definitely. Trump's Space Force, this announcement. But we know that there's been a secret Space Force for years. Now, is this secret space program that started after World War II?
Well, I think it started about the time that it was definitely after World War II, but I think it was more towards the time when President Kennedy said that we were going to the moon, because that's how they funded their secret space program, was they ripped off the money from Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, which were all fake. We never went to the moon. And we faked the Mercury launches, most of them. We faked most of the Gemini launches. And, of course, none of the Apollo missions ever went. But, and they used that $40 billion to finance the space program. And when the shuttle came along, one of the things that Ron Schmidt was the guy who started livingmoon.com that I did a lot of work for, and he and I were the ones that figured out what the shuttle was doing. Now, when the shuttle would launch, it would always take 2.5 days to get up to the International Space Station, and we couldn't figure out why, because it only took the Russians in the Soyuz 37 minutes to get there. And then the other thing was, when it came back, it would always take 2.5 days to come back, when it only took the Russians 45 minutes to come from the International Space Station back to Earth. So it took us a while to figure out what was going on. And of course, NASA's chief disinformation agent, Jim Olberg, was coming up with such ridiculous reasons why it was delayed. You know, one of his reasons was they had just spent 10 days at the International Space Station working, and when they came back, they were giving him the crew rest on their way back. 2.5 days of crew rest. You know, it was just stupid. It was so silly, his excuses. But anyway, what happened is we got a picture. NASA released a picture of one of the shuttles arriving at the International Space Station, and the cargo door opened, and it was only half full. And we figured, where's the other half? Where did it go? And what they were doing was they were loading it up with the stuff for the secret orbiting direct energy weapons and other things that they had going, and they were flying around in different orbits delivering all that stuff and using the delay to get to the space station of 2.5 days, saying that that's just orbital mechanics. And then what would happen is that we noticed that every time the shuttle would launch towards the International Space Station, the Russians would launch the Soyuz that same day. And so we got a hold of the manifest for the Soyuz cargo vehicle, and it was full of food. And we couldn't, where's all this food? There's only, what, 4, 5, 6 guys up on the International Space Station. Where's all this food going? Well, what happened is when the shuttle would get up to the International Space Station and deliver what little parts they had for it, the Soyuz would have already arrived there, and they unloaded all the food and supplies from the Soyuz onto the shuttle. And then when the shuttle launched back to Earth, it would go to the various different space stations delivering the food and supplies. And that's what took them 2.5 days to get back. So, you know, that's when that would have been, the middle 80s, beginning of the 90s, and that's when they got a lot of the stuff going in orbit. The Navy has so many programs in orbit. You know, one of them is they have these steel factories, and it's not actually steel. It's a metal that's called D.D. And what it is, it's a metal that can only be made in zero gravity, and it's lighter than titanium, stronger than steel, and with a small electrical charge, it can repel water from 5 to 7 centimeters away from this metal. So if you use it as a hull material, say for submarines or aircraft carriers, with a small electrical charge, you can keep the water 5 to 7 centimeters away and decrease the drag to zero. Now, we know that the V-based hulls of current crafts that to go through the water, the formula is 1.34 times the square root of the water line is the maximum speed. And that works out to be about, 45 knots for aircraft carriers or submarines or anything that uses a hull in the water. But if you can keep the water away from the hull, you have no drag at all. And now the submarines, like you'll notice in the last few months, they launched the Virginia class Block 2 submarines, one of which was the USS Colorado. And they actually had a picture of some of the stuff they new stuff on there. The Navy said it has new great technology, but they never told the public what the technology is. But what the technology is they're using this D.D as a hull material so that these submarines can go over 100 knots through the water. And they use the fusion engines. And the public is told that fusion won't be usable or perfected for another decade, which is baloney. They've been using it for 10 years. And it's lighter than fission reactors, and it's 10 times more powerful. And then the other thing they've got, the third part of the technology for the Block II submarines, the Virginia-class Block II submarines, is the jet propulsion that they use instead of propellers. And there's a picture that the Navy released of what that thing looks like on the back of a submarine. And it's a way they have of propelling the submarine through the water with much less noise than a propeller makes. So those three things are what were in the new Block II Virginia class that they were launching. Now also, they launched the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier, which is the largest aircraft carrier that's been launched, and it uses D.D for its hull and enables this huge, massive aircraft carrier to go over 100 knots through the water. And I asked, you know, some of the guys that have been on that, how do they keep that secret from the crew? They said, well, it's very simple. Number one, whenever they've got to go somewhere, all the crew is confined below decks and not to go up there. And they tell them it's for weather. And then when they get somewhere and the time doesn't make any sense, in other words, how did they get 1,000 miles in a couple hours? The Navy people know, or if you work for the Navy, you know better than to ask questions that you shouldn't be asking. And, you know, that's true for the submarine that launched the missile that accidentally shot down TWA 800. Those guys were, you know, they know better than to talk about stuff like that. And the Navy sent all 80 seamen that were on that submarine, put all 80 in 80 different places around the world so they couldn't compare their stories or talk about it. So it's pretty simple to keep a secret in the Navy.
Yeah, and now we have all this advanced technology, and you said earlier that the moon landing was fake, but have we ever gone to the moon with this advanced technology that we have at all?
Probably not. If we've gone, it was only, you know, a lot of people have gone to the moon, and they've gone there as the guests of the people who live there. Now, there's 2 billion, at least 2 billion people, the humans that live on the moon, and they've been there for forever. You know, the moon was made on Jupiter 38 million years ago, and it's been towed around the solar system. Our solar system for 38 million years, and only showed up in Earth here at the end of the last ice age about 15,000 years ago. And it was put in orbit around here. And NASA tells us that our solar system has 9 planets. That's baloney. There's 40 planets in our solar system. Some of them NASA knows about. Most of them they don't, because they're hidden. And they're hidden in different ways. But all of these planets have civilizations. Some are human, some are, you know, other types of ETs. They all have moons, and all the moons have different civilizations. And there's so much going on in our solar system. It's hard to believe. You learn about it, and you can't believe that much is going on. And the humans here on Earth are just the local morons. We know nothing, which is kind of hilarious. But, you know, Chris, we're only here on Earth for one job, and that is that You know, we have all lived, you, me, anybody you know has always have all lived at least 200 or 300 lives prior to this one, prior to the one coming to Earth. None of us are from Earth. We're from somewhere else in space, maybe the solar system, maybe much further out. But the reason we're here is we made some kind of mistake in our last life, and we're down here to learn how to live our lives with integrity, without envy, without hate, without greed, and to learn to express our love to our families each and every day. That's all we're supposed to do here. That's all we're supposed to learn. Now, if we're successful, and when we pass away, you remember when Steve Jobs passed away here about 2 years ago, his whole family was around his bed, and just about 10 seconds before he totally expired, he goes, "Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow." And what he was seeing was the place, the fourth dimension, the kind of lobby that you go to when you pass away. And you're met by whoever you believe in. If you believe in God, if you believe in Allah, in my case, it would be the Great Pumpkin who would meet me. But whoever it is that you believe in, they meet you, and they take you to reintroduce you to some of the people you met in your past lives. And after about 30 or 40 minutes, they take you to a room, and you have a life review. And this life review shows you in three-dimensional color and sound, which is just absolutely real. You can't believe that somebody took the time to take photos or a video of your entire life, every single second of your life, and it shows you all the wonderful and loving things that you did during your life and all the nice things you did, and then they show you all the nasty things you did, all the stuff that you did that you don't think anybody could possibly know, and they show it to you in living color video, three-dimensional with sound. And after they show you that, the decision is made, and I don't know who makes the decision. The decision is made whether you have to come back to Earth and spend more time learning how to live with integrity, without envy, without hate, without greed, and learning to love your family each and every day, or whether you get to stay there in the fourth dimension, which is what we call heaven. Now, if you have a concept of heaven, multiply that exponentially by 1,000 times, and that's how fantastic it is. And of course, if everybody knew how fantastic it was, they'd spend a lot more time learning how to live with integrity without envy, hate, or greed. But they can't tell them that, because that's part of the secret. You've got that has to come from within. You can't be doing that, learning how to live with integrity and behaving great to get something. You have to do that because it just comes naturally from within.
Now, would you consider Earth some sort of simulation, or even like a prison planet?
It is a prison. It is a prison planet. For most of us, a prison planet. Now, some people come down here for different reasons. You know, we're told that there's between 7 and 8 billion people on the planet Earth. What they don't know is that 25% of those are actually ETs dressed up to be humans. There's only about 5.5 real humans down here on Earth. 5.5 billion real humans.
That is fascinating. So we could come into contact with these ETs on a daily basis and not even know it.
On a daily basis, not even know it. And that happens a lot in Las Vegas. I have more friends that give me these stories about, you know, being in some casino and absolutely knowing that person over there, whoever it was, has got to be an ET. And the way you can check get out, if you see somebody you think is an ET, just go up kind of close to them, stand behind them, and think real hard and say, I know you're an alien. And you'll watch them jerk around.
Wow.
And I've had some friends that do that, and it's hilarious how it works.
Now, do we have some sort of agreement with these ETs? I mean, are they working with our government in any way?
No, they have their own agenda, and I don't know what the agenda is. We don't. The only agreements we have are false agreements. You know, the one that was made with, they tried to make with Eisenhower in 1954, and then they made it with somebody else in 1963 at down there near El Paso with the landing there. And what the agreement was that we would help keep the secret of ET, and the secret is that they don't exist. We would help keep that, and we would limit the abductions that were going on to a finite number. And I don't know what the number was, but we knew the abductions were going on, and we were trying to get it to stop, and they weren't going to stop. And the fact is, abductions happen to every single human being on the face of the earth, because the people who made us have to do checkouts every few years or so, and they come and pick you up once when you're 3, once when you're 7, once when you're 11, once when you're 13, and then as required throughout your life. And everybody is abducted. We used to, I remember when I first got into this UFO business, we thought that it was 1 in 10 that were abducted, but no, it's everybody. And they take you to the moon, where they have their bases inside of the moon. Now the moon isn't hollow like a tennis ball, but it does have huge openings and caverns, just like we do on Earth, and that's where they have their laboratories. And I'm kind of fortunate enough now that I have two of my family members, grandsons and granddaughters, that have total recall of being on the moon. It's kind of interesting.
Does this just occur on the dark side of the moon, to where we can't see?
Pardon?
Does this just occur on the dark side of the moon, to where we aren't seeing this?
No. What happens is when we look at the moon at night, we're looking at a holograph. What we're seeing, those craters and Mares and mountains and stuff, that's a holograph. That's not really there. Just recently, here about 6 months ago, a guy named Bruce Swartz bought a 14-inch telescope and figured out a way to penetrate the hologram. And if you go to Bruce Says All, that's B-R-U,
I've seen his
TV. You can see the photos. You can see the photos he's taken of the industrial areas on the moon. They're fantastic. I mean, thousands of buildings and roadways and roads and bridges and tunnels and all kinds of stuff. It's just fantastic. I've copied some of those and put them on my wall because they're so interesting. But when we look at the moon, we're just seeing a hologram. That's what they want us to see. That's not what's really there. People talk about bases on the backside of the moon. There's more stuff on the front side than there is on the backside. But that's because, you know, we're looking at a hologram. We're not allowed to see what's going on up there.
Why do you think that that we're not having disclosure? Do you think that people can't handle it? I mean, the people, I see a lot more open to it now than in the past. What are your thoughts on that?
No, there will never be disclosure. Number one is ET doesn't want it. And they're going to do everything they can to be sure it happens. So the people that are talking about disclosure do not know what they're talking about. And yes, it's true that some people could take it, but most can't.
Now, do you think that there will be a time where it'll be kind of a forced disclosure, where it will be a large scale event where there's no more hiding it?
If there is, it'll be a fake event. It'll be something that the administration or some power will want to do for some reason other than give us the real story. The only way you can find the real story is to seek it out yourself and figure it out yourself, because there is never, ever going to be disclosure.
Very good. Now, what about here on Earth? You hear stories of underground bases and undersea bases. Have you done any research into that?
Yep. And I'll tell you what it is. You won't believe me, but there was so much going on under the Earth. It's just absolutely incredible. When I first, you know, I used to drive back and forth to Reno, where my folks live, from Las Vegas, and I'd always go by Hawthorne. Now, Hawthorne's about halfway between here and Reno, and it has a little lake there. It's about 100 feet deep, and it's about 15 miles long, and there's a big sign at the entrance to Hawthorne. It says, U.S. Naval Undersea Warfare Center. Now, you're not going to have an undersea warfare center on a lake that's 100 feet deep.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
Right.
So it took me years to find out, and I kept hearing these rumors about a submarine base under the Nevada desert. And I just couldn't figure it out until finally I met a guy that worked up there and had great personal danger to himself. He told me that the seven or eight western states of the United States of America are floating on a ledge that floats on the Pacific Ocean, and the Pacific Ocean underlies those seven or eight states. And there's the entrance ways to get under there. One's at Monterey Bay. I think it's called, I forget the name of the landing there. And there's one in Malibu, California. And there's pictures on the internet. I posted pictures of it. There's pictures on the livingmoon.com of these areas. And the submarines can go through these canyons that take you under the edge of the shelf that the states are built on, and they can go anywhere they want in these seven or eight states. Now, what they do, the reason they use Hawthorne is because Hawthorne is where they make the secret missiles and weapons that they use onboard submarines. And prior to them having this undersea base, they used to have to ship it by road up through Reno to Alameda in San Francisco, or south through Las Vegas to San Diego to the submarine base there. And starting about, I think, 30 years ago, they dug an elevator shaft. It's a huge shaft, which goes from Hawthorne, 3,200 feet down to the Pacific Ocean. And what they can do is load these missiles on that elevator, and it takes them down to the level of the Pacific Ocean. And there is a large submarine base there under Hawthorne, but there's also submarine bases all over the place under these seven states. A friend of mine was a SEAL team member. As a matter of fact, he was one of the SEAL Team 6 members. He was one of the first guys to be a SEAL, and we were pretty good friends. And he told me that there was an entrance at Lake Tahoe that they used to get to the Pacific Ocean. there's an elevator that goes down from there. And apparently that's what Jack Cousteau saw many years ago when he dove under Lake Tahoe down very, very deep. And when he came up, they said, "What'd you see? What'd you see?" He said, "What I saw was not information that people should know about." And so I had always wondered about that, but there's obviously something pretty deep there that that we should know. But the Navy has these facilities all over the place.
Now, have you ever done any research into the possibilities of what could be in Antarctica?
No, but it's really interesting, and that would be the only place that I wouldn't really do any research. I've never been afraid of anything. I've never been threatened by anything or anybody. But Antarctica, I would stay away because they're pretty definite about us not knowing. And I say they, ET is pretty definite about us not knowing what's going on there. Now, obviously there's a huge ET base there. And, it's much bigger than we can imagine, much bigger than Los Angeles, much bigger than New York. It's all covered with ice. But the people that have gotten glimpses in there say it's absolutely enormous. And it's going to be kept secret forever and ever.
Very interesting. Now, earlier you were talking about how we're basically reincarnated to this sort of prison planet over and over. Now, until we sort of learn what we need to learn, would you consider that we live in a sort of multiverse where there are thousands, if not millions, of similar existences occurring at the same time?
I don't think so. It could be. I don't say that something couldn't happen. It's just not what I think is going on. But we do all live these hundreds of lives, and there's so many stories that come up with little kids that are 6 and 7 years old talking about the previous life. You remember the one that remembered he was a Navy fighter pilot during World War II and remembered bombing Iwo Jima. And at 6 years old, he could name all the parts of the airplane, the bomb releases and the stick and all that stuff in there. It's just so obvious that that's going on.
Now, do you think that Earth is the only sort of prison planet or matrix simulation, or are there other planets in this solar system that are similar?
Earth is the only one in our solar system, but there are billions upon billions of prison planets. You know, one of the problems that we're fed here on Earth is this Big Bang bullshit, and that the universe started out with a Big Bang.
Right.
And there's a moron who goes around talking to people. His book is called Astrophysics for Those People in a Hurry. And I think it's been on the New York bestseller list for something like 62 weeks. And it's so full of bullshit. I don't know how he can get away with this. But one of the things he talks about is there being a Big Bang. There was no Big Bang. The universe has been in existence forever and will be in existence forever. I mean, there was no beginning, there was no end, there was no Big Bang.
Do you think
so? One of the things I try to do, Chris, is try to figure out how to tell somebody how big the universe is. And there just aren't any words, to say, how huge it is. And I've been trying to figure out a way to say, well, here's how big it is. Just imagine the biggest thing you can imagine in the world and then multiply that exponentially by a million. That's not even close to how big the universe is. But go ahead, I interrupted
you. No, well, there's been so many things, basically everything about our history, everything about space that we've been lied to. We're definitely in a controlled system. And do you think that this has always been by design to keep us in this controlled system through religion and things like that, through our media?
Absolutely, 100%. You nailed it. The Earth is, you know, they tell us it's 5 billion years old. It's actually 14 billion years old. And there have been so many civilizations on Earth, more than 1,000, civilizations that were far, far more advanced than ours. And for one reason or another, they're not here anymore. Sometimes E.T. Decides to be done with the civilization. Sometimes there's other causes, but there have been at least 1,000. Now, we know of Atlantis, and there's several others that we know about, and we have found places that are suspect of where there might have been something, but there is so much that has gone on that we know nothing about. You know, one of the things is the Sahara Desert used to be a beautiful, fertile forest land, and the Appalachian Mountains, the Appalachian Range, is actually it covers a range of about 200 pyramids, larger than the Cheops pyramids in Egypt. And pyramids in previous times, and I don't know when previous is, whether it's, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago, they were something to do with the power system, getting the radiated energy from the sun and amplified by the pyramids and transmitted around the Earth. That's why we find pyramids down in Central America, Mexico, South America, all over the place.
Now, Mr. Lear, that was fascinating information. Before you go, is there anything interesting upcoming for you that you'd like to talk about before you head out?
Chris, I just want to say that, you know, everybody to know that the only thing they have to do here on Earth is to live their life with integrity, without envy, hate, or greed, and to express their love to their family each and every day. That's the best information I can give you.
Very well said. And that's the perfect way to close out. Thank you again, Mr. Lear, for joining us. That was some fascinating information, and we'd love to have you back on sometime.
My pleasure. Call me anytime.
All right. Thank you. And you have a great night.
Okay. Thank you.